Really?
I see balls flying deeper into the stands. I see them going out all parts of the field by guys who, if they hit them right on the screws, would have a tough time getting them over the fence at certain times in the past.
More so than in 87?
I think
they definitely juiced.
Yeah, I think
really
it's
juiced them that year.
I really do.
Yeah.
I think it's back. I really do. See guys just swinging. The ball just keeps on going. Just keeps on going. High ones too, you know, those kind of you think might be a good long high fly ball. Just keep going and going, and it's a long high fly ball, but it's out of the ballpark.
Did the mound at Dodger Stadium make that big a difference? The slope of the mound, is that?
I think that
always been a factor there.
I think it was definitely an advantage to the Dodgers pitchers because that's when they threw on the most, and they acclimated very well to that mound. Even though you could say that, you know, there was a limitation on the height and so on, and you always put the deal out there, but that, I think what they did is raise home plate up a little bit to make it more even.
Is that right? And they would have done that in 69, of
sure.
course, with the, let's say, the lowering of the mound. They would
sure.
have had to do something.
Yeah, they did something.
Because they had two 20-game winners that year. It's not like...
69?
Yeah, I think so. Singer and Osteen, I believe.
Osteen.
It didn't slow them down much, did it?
No.
Let's talk about Curt Flood.
Yeah.
Case. I've read his book, which is a fascinating book, that he wrote in 70 or 71. I've read various accounts. When he gave his presentation, or whatever you call it, at those winter meetings,
mm-hmm.
Was there antipathy toward him at the start, or sympathy?
No, I think there was curiosity. I think in some cases there might have been some sympathy. I don't think a whole lot. I think that there was some questions in our minds as to why he was doing it. I think I asked him specifically, are you doing it just because you're black? To further the black cause, you know, black man's cause? And no, he's doing it just because he felt this particular thing was very important to him as an individual and to baseball as a whole. And so that satisfied me, you know, because I had that question on my mind. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know if anybody else had it on their mind, but I asked it, you know.
Yeah. Miller in his book puts it that you asked the question that was on everybody's mind.
Okay. So and he answered it to my satisfaction, because I think he's very sincere in his answer. And I believe that he did it not to gain anything financially by writing a book and all that. That's what was, I think, on our minds.
Mm-hmm.
He did it because he thought this was the proper thing to do.
Of course, it was coming on the heels of two or even three players who had retired to get contract leverage that year. Don Clendenin first.
Yeah.
And Ken Harrelson was the more publicized mm-hmm. one. And even Maury Wills retired briefly
mm-hmm.
just before he got traded back to the Dodgers.
It was
June or July
yeah,
of 69. Yeah. Was that part of the skepticism?
I think so. I think the biggest part was whether or not he was just trying to do this for monetary gain, personal monetary gain.
Mm-hmm. And as we've seen, he sure didn't.
No, he didn't. I mean, And to leaving prior to that time, you know, he had gone over to, Morocco, or what's the island over there?
Mallorca.
I mean, he didn't get the best of publicity, if you recall, prior to that incident. But, so I think some of the players were a little skeptical about this whole thing. He had gone to Mallorca, and, to be honest with you, I think he hit the bottle pretty good too, you know, and so people they knew him better than I. Some of those guys knew him better than I for his personal life and that kind of stuff. But you always hear things, but
mm-hmm.
so I think, like you said, you know, the question was on our minds: why was he doing this? What was the real reason?
It's turned out that he was a man of as high principles he
mm-hmm.
avowed.
Yeah, when it came to that, and heck, it ended up where he ended up getting Goldberg as a defense lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't have a lightweight.
Right.
I mean, he had a former Supreme Court justice, wasn't he? Was he
yeah.
former at that time?
Yes.
Yeah, he's going back into private practice,
right.
I think. Yeah. So he certainly had a guy who knew the ropes and knew what, what the insight was and all this kind of stuff, but it was interesting because he was in essence asking us to pay as well.
Right.
The, you know, Players Association, which I think we did pay some of his defense.
Right. Yeah. I think it came to $100,000 or $200,000,
like,
which is considerable at that time.
Sure. A lot of us weren't making that though.
did Miller point out the long-range benefits of supporting that lawsuit, or was it...
I think he did.
Was it, this is for Kurt Flood, or this is...
No,
I
think he tried to persuade us that this was in the interest of everyone involved in baseball from the player standpoint. This is something that the players should get resolved. And because it'll have an effect on their future. And I think that we were convinced that it was that important, one way or another.
And I believe he was correctly advising Flood that he probably wasn't going to win the case.
Very possible. But he knew by bringing it up, I think, in that forum, and giving it to the Supreme Court, that something was going to be shaken up somewhere along the line. Probably didn't know exactly how. They probably didn't realize the judge in Kansas City was going to uphold him.
Right? Mm-hmm.
But as it turned out, there was enough brought to light,
as
enough focus on it, that you know you're going to get some, if you get the right judge, he's going to think the way you do. And if you get it in front of him, bingo, you got at least now you might have him give you a decision temporarily for a while, but you get everybody now looking at this in a different frame of mind.
Right. Turned out that what he got on record was the owner's change, shifted stance.
He put
the pressure on him, and they bent the right way.
That's exactly right.
What I really have to marvel at what Miller did.
from where the players were to where they are today, it's phenomenal. And the player today doesn't really realize how it is. All the steps that transpire, and the players didn't win every time, but they, you know, one thing, they were well prepared when they went into the fight.
That's one of my aims in approaching this book, is that it isn't that long ago.
Well, like you said, what, 27 years ago?
Miller arrived.
He got on the scene, 27 years. And look at the progress that has been made. Look at it in increments of 5 years, and how it's transpired over those increments. Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
My feeling is that if Miller had represented the American Indians, the American Indians would be running the Dakotas and Montana and a couple of other states.
But you know the irony of that? He represented the steelworkers, and the steelworkers didn't make out that well from the standpoint of pensions and all that stuff. My dad worked for U.S. Steel for 31 years. For 31 years of service, he gets $72 a month pension. See, that's, of course, now you're looking years ago, but the irony of all of that is, here's a guy that worked in an industry whose employment is way down and benefits and all that stuff. Not commensurate to a lot of other industries, but he goes into baseball and he flips it upside down. He does a super job.
He couldn't have done it without the owners, though.
That's right. See, and I think his experience in the steel industry allowed him to anticipate and see ahead of the owners. He had a great grasp of being able to identify his commodity. Owners didn't think much of their commodity, and Marvin made the commodity believe more in themselves and in their self-worth, and so consequently once he convinced them of that, he had them in the palm of it, and so whatever he was going to, whatever direction, he had 100, he had the backing.
It was the same path.
He'll attack from this direction, he's got them all behind, attack from that. He had that. Once he convinced that the players that what he was doing was right and was for them because they deserved it. And all of us with our egos, we think we should get a little more of this pot.
That's why I think that spring training boycott is so important.
Yeah.
In the books that I've read covering history of the union and stuff, it isn't given very much attention.
Yeah.
Because it didn't result in a strike or anything major.
Right.
It was averted before it reached that point.
Right,
exactly.
But
it set the tone.
My premise, yeah.
It set the tone. And it grew from that point on.
Yeah, I believe if the owners had, I don't know how, but if the owners had won that battle and just didn't do anything until the players just showed up because the players were going to want to show up.
Exactly.
After a fail-safe point, the players would have to show up.
Sure.
Right?
Right. Exactly. You know, you go back, though, to when we were first hired. We had a meeting in New York. Player reps, several of us, I don't know if all of us were there. We may have all been there. Quite a few of us. And ownership. In a hotel in New York. All in the same room. And Marvin was there, and this is, I think, one of the very first meetings that he was present as far as the collective ownership was concerned. It was interesting. And this is where ownership was going to scare us to death, because they were now going to make us pay for our dues to go pay for the associations. And it was great. I mean, this should have given them a little insight as to what type of man they were dealing with. Because they wanted to hang their hat on the antitrust laws, where you couldn't take that money, i.e. the dues that we were paying into our contributory pension fund at that time, which was contributory. We put in $2 a day every day you're in the major leagues. Well, that money was contributed towards the pension fund. Ownership would supplement that and so whatever. Well, what would happen, whenever there was a meeting, player representative meeting, they would subsidize the meeting out of those funds, because they're talking about pension stuff and all, okay? And now ownership was going to be really smart. Well, you can't take money from that, you know, because that's against the antitrust law. Taft-Hartley, that's the law. The Taft-Hartley law, yeah. You can't do that. Oh, well, so it happens they've been doing it for years. Now all of a sudden you can't do it, right? Because
right.
Our director...
Marvin instead of Judge Cannon.
Yeah, that's right. You're going to have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Well, then that, we won't contribute to the pension, and we'll just put the money toward the dues. Well, if that's what's going to, you know. But it was funny, the part, the Taft-Hartley law, you can't do that. Up until that time, they were doing it. They were violating the law all that time, right? Oh, that was a good meeting right there. So they should have known right there they had, you know, tiger by the tail, and they didn't learn.
They wanted it both ways, and
yeah,
Miller wouldn't give them either way.
No, and they wanted to get Miller out of the way, and this is one way they're going to do it. They're going to scare the association into seeing that, hey, boy, you get this guy on, you know, you're going to be in all kinds of legal problems and everything else, you know, because what you've been doing is illegal. It got resolved. That was funny.
Yeah, the players came up.
Yeah.
Who were some of the other player reps who stand out in your mind?
Tommy Seaver, Brooks Robinson. There were two that that would express their opinion, vocal. Trying to think down in Texas. That strike vote.
72.
Yeah. Well, those two, Seaver and Brooks, and of course, the initial guys were Jim Bunning was involved. So was Robin Roberts. She was a spirit carrier for Marvin. I think that initially he was one of the guys that was on the screening committee. But Bunning, Brooks, and Seaver that I can recall. I can't remember too many of them.
Were there times when you wished that you weren't a player rep?
I don't know. I think you look back, and I've forgotten so much of it now, but if you look back, it was a good experience. I think in some ways, some short-sighted people on management felt that it was a detriment to be a player rep. I don't think
that's why they kept trading.
Yeah, one period looked like it was the case. You know, it's sad because you would hope that you would want knowledgeable people in your organization, people that you could talk to about things and sit down and reason, rather than people you can just dominate, this, you know, and just tell them to do this, do that, and whatever, you know, and then just discard it. You think you'd have a little more compassion with people in that respect. But, you know, I'm glad that it was a great experience for me to be part of those negotiations in certain areas and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of disillusionment and resentment toward the owners as their bargaining tactics emerged? Or
I think from some people. I think a lot of us saw that they're fighting for what they think is right. We're fighting for what we think is right. And there's nothing wrong with that, believing in your stance. And I think the important thing was, okay, if that's the case, where's the ground we can both live with? You know, where's the ground we can compromise in? Because we do need each other. And so I think, but I think in some cases some of the players felt that the ownership were complete jerks and vice versa. You know? So, but you know, fortunately,
rightly in some cases,
yeah,
right? Inevitably,
yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the nature of egos when you get them together. You know? But you know, the fact that you had a guy like a Marvin Miller who knew the art of give and take, that you could sit down and resolve some of these situations that we, as uneducated ball players in those areas, look at it and say, oh my goodness, what are we going to do now? You know, that's good to have the pro right there.
Right. Do you think these changes would have come about anyway?
Which changes are you talking about?
Everything that Miller did.
I think eventually, in some respects, more with more turmoil. You know, the farther we got down the line without having some things done. But I think it was good for all the sport. Baseball has been the leader in a lot of ways, in a lot of areas, i.e. pensions and so on.
Yeah.
And I think this has helped a lot of other sports as well, not only baseball. I think maybe, as I say, maybe there would these changes would come about much slower, maybe more to the advantage of ownership, possibly, than they are now. But again, more turmoil. Yeah. I think you would have more turmoil. Ready to, even though, you know, as you look back, it was a tumultuous time at times. But in the long run, nobody got killed. Nobody, you know, really got hurt. I don't ever recall any owner who has sold his team to say he was forced out of baseball, you know, because it was the players' fault. I mean, players are taking the money that they're being given at this stage of the game.
Right.
And if you want to keep doling that out, they're right. going to keep taking it.
Right. They're busy blaming each other.
Sure. Yeah. So they don't have to get their act together. I think ownership, when you're dealing with so few powerful men and the egos you're dealing with, makes it much more difficult for the commissioner to control them than it was for Marvin Miller to control players, even though there were 10 times more players than there were owners.
Sure. I think it's Coppard who points out that to become a baseball owner, you have to have had a lifetime of accumulating and running over people and then getting what you want without too much effective opposition.
Yeah.
So
it's
they weren't conditioned
to
compromise.
Yeah. And you know, baseball is a different commodity than what all the other, what they were dealing with. You know, some dealing in ships, some dealing in liquor, some dealing in lumber, some dealing in, you know, other types of commodities. But now you're dealing with a human being. You know, how are you going to treat this human being? You're going to treat him like a piece of cheese, or are you going to treat him with dignity and with respect and not always give him what he wants, but at least give him the opportunity to express how he feels, what he thinks is right, and then sit down and iron something out.
Yeah, I think that was Flood's point in principle.
Yeah.
that the reserve clause made players, he said, in the hierarchy of living things, ball players are like poultry.
Right. Exactly. They were chattel. I mean, our contracts were, if you didn't play for the team that you were originally signed to, you got to wait to see what they were going to do. They could put you on a suspended list for the rest of your life. You couldn't, unless you got off of that, you couldn't go play for another team.
Yeah.
All of those things that were involved.
Yeah, Landis did a lot of heavy-handed things, too.
Yeah.
There was a guy named Benny Kauf who was arrested for possessing stolen property, stolen automobile.
Mm-hmm.
And Landis suspended him for life before he even went to trial. And after Kauf was found not guilty, Landis didn't rescind the suspension. No.
See, now that's wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's wrong. And, you know, and he nailed some owners, too. And he nailed, you know, Leo DeRocher, a manager at that time. But, I mean, boy, you're going to put a lifetime suspension on somebody. You better be pretty right. That's like putting him in prison for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
Better be right.
At the time it happened, it was, you know, clean up baseball, no taint or hint of.
And he squashed some players going down to Mexico too, didn't he?
He sure did.
A couple of them got back in, but
well, including the father of one of your old teammates, Max Lanier.
Yeah, that's right.
I hope if I can get myself to Florida, I think that's where they live.
Yeah, they were. Is he still living?
I believe so. Sometime in my travels, I hope to get down there and talk to them because they'd have an interesting perspective on it.
Oh, yeah.
Hal's father
had gone through it. What is the premise of your book?
My premise is I've told you in bits and pieces what it is, that I'm basically a novelist, and I look at the players' lives as if. Is if your life was a novel, and the chapter for 1969 is this unprecedented crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Here it's time to go to spring training, get ready for the season, and here the man is doing a lot for you. Says, no, don't sign a contract, don't go, don't practice, don't give the owners any clue that you are itching to play. Baseball is such a precarious profession anyway, between injuries and rookies coming along to take your job. It's such a fragile thing, it seems to me, that it was a what I would call a crisis of conscience for you men that year.
It was.
Do I, it's obvious what the right thing in principle is, but is it going to be my ass that pays the price for it?
It's going to feed my family.
Yeah. What am I going to do if my owner, if I'm playing for Paul Richards or Calvin Griffith, these guys aren't going to give me any air. And I'm focusing on the player reps because they knew the most about what was going on, and some of them paid the price. Joe Torre got vilified by Richards that winter and traded right at the end of spring training.
Good for Joe.
Yeah, right?
It turned out well
for him,
yeah.
Even though he missed out on a World Series ring.
Yeah.
On both sides. Still.
Yeah.
Still. Well,
it's crazy.
That's the focus of my book. This was an uncommon baseball season in almost every respect. You know, with playoffs coming in, mm-hmm. expansion, changing the mound and all the other things that were going on. Almost no area of baseball was stable from 68 to 69.
Mm-hmm.
I did a tally of everybody who played in the majors in 68. I think it was 40% changed teams from the start of 68 to the end of the calendar year 69.
Oh, my goodness. 40%.
20%. Well, with expansion, of course, had
sure,
accounts for a fair chunk of that.
Yeah.
But it just intensifies the general fragility of a baseball career to be in the middle of this first labor dispute, the first time you guys were trying to feel your oats, and the most Miller had ever asked you to do.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, back in 1950, 13, I think, 12 or 13, there was an attempt to have all the players not sign their contracts.
Oh, was there?
Yeah, a man named Dave Fultz, who was head of a players' association back then, tried to do this. They had quite a bit more to do with the minor leaguers who got the shaft regularly back then. The minors, they haven't cleaned up that mess at all, have they?
In 1972, to tell you a little story that I have to chuckle at, because that's the year we went on strike.
Yeah.
Now, I was traded from the Dodgers to the Tigers in that winter, and I go over to Detroit, and those turkeys, and all their older players, you got Kaline, Cash, you got Northrup, you got Stanley, you got Freehand, you got McCullough, you got all the older players. I mean, it was a good, solid bubble. They elect me the player rep. They throw me to the wolves, right? So I go to Texas, in Dallas, we have our meeting. Call a meeting, Marvin called me, we all go fly down there. And I'm representing the Tigers at the time. And now we vote to strike. Because what Marvin told us in Dallas, we felt we were right to strike. They didn't want to take some money that was sitting there that could have been used for some benefit, and so bingo, we strike. So I get back and I report to the players in Lakeland. We all disperse, we go home, right? So we strike, I think, about 9 days, if I recall.
Yeah.
Something like that. Now we finally open up in Detroit. Season starts, right? And now here's Detroit, one of the strongest union towns in the world, right? You talk about strong unions, the workers, the car workers, whatever they call them,
UAW,
yeah. So now they do the normal thing, introduce all the players, before the opening day. They introduced me, and they booed like a son. They just booed like I said, I'll be there.
They've never seen you before.
I said, yeah, never been there before. Here I am. Here we are, quote, working men, looking, and we go on strike, which they did every 3 years anyway, And they booed me. I said, yeah, that's nice. It's nice. It's a good, strong union piece.
Brooks Robinson got booed in Baltimore.
Did he that year?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
that was, jumped around. That was.
Dude. And then that negotiation, that was an interesting negotiation. You go in and sit down, we're talking about executive committee, then was the two league presidents and the commissioner, I think, and they had their negotiating guy, they had some lawyer or something. So anyway, so we go in and we're talking, and I asked him, something like this across the table. Chubb Feeney, I knew well because he was my general manager. Said, Chubb, now let me ask you one question. I said, when we start this season, which we're going to do someday, when we start, is every team going to play the same number of games? Yes, every team plays the same number of games. No exception. We started wherever the season was at that time, right?
Yep.
We ended up winning our division in 72 by
extra
half a game.
Yeah.
That's right.
But the Red Sox didn't get to play.
Exactly. Is that so? Oh, yeah. Everybody's got to be fair. Everybody's going to play the same number of games. So that's
right. Well, I get the second half of that 9-day strike was negotiating over whether players were going to get paid for games that didn't get paid later. Or
we didn't. We didn't get paid for plays the games that we didn't play.
Right, but they didn't force you to play them for nothing.
Right.
You didn't play them, and you didn't get paid.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
At one time, they wanted to make you play them for nothing.
Make them up, and then, that's right. And we said, look, no, don't play, don't get paid. Yeah. So, I think, back at that time, the average salary in 72 was $36,000. 20 years later, it's over a million.
I know. Well, in 67, I think the figure I saw was one-third of all players made $10,000 or less in 67.
Granted, you didn't have big TV contracts.
Right.
You didn't charge, $13, $14 a seat. But when you drew 2 million people in there, you made some money. They were making money hand over fist back then. Just hand over fist. The Giants and Dodgers did. Right?
Sure.
Coming from the east out to the west, and they were packed. Incredible. That shit on.
some guys got the payback.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's all I came in with. So.